Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we are talking Lebanon. Martin, you made the point when we were speaking earlier that this is something that, you know, judging by the books on my walls is somewhere I've always wanted to go. Absolutely. I would say with someone I've always wanted to go and never actually got there. And it's something that really has troubled me before what's happened. I hate to do this now because it's really cheesy, but bit of housekeeping, guys.
I'll take over, Tony. You can do the series. Guys, look, we need you to keep signing up as patrons. The more patrons, the more podcasts, the more you know, the more we know. It's all a big circle of love. So look, sign in there, patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Price of a cup of coffee. Keep this show on the road.
Much more importantly, we're delighted to be joined on the line by Seamus Malakafaz Ali. And I've butchered your name, Seamus, because I'm surprised that there's a man who is of Irish-Iranian heritage and they kept the fada on the E, pal. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's about honoring the Irish language.
Yeah. When I saw it, I said, well, the fada is still there. There's a man who knows what he's talking about. Listen, I'm sorry that we're going to go so dark so quickly, but the explosion that has happened, the ammonia nitrate, and you know, you don't have to go far back in our generation. Do we know the dangers of ammonia nitrate in Ireland and its uses for other purposes? Obviously, you know, there's a blame game going on at the moment. But before that ever went off, there was already an economic time bomb that was going off. Do you want to give our listeners an idea of what the situation was, even pre-explosion?
We could do a like 7-hour podcast about how exactly this happened, but just in the brief context that we have right here, Lebanon has been basically built on a banking system that could be very well compared to a Ponzi scheme on a national level. Lots of things with cash reserves and keeping foreign reserves high and then constantly having to use those cash reserves to fund basic things. Using the U.S. dollar in tandem with your regular currency, which makes it less valuable. And then everything, all of the massive corruption that was inherent to the Lebanese political system finally came to a hilt around, I want to say, September of last year. And in September of last year, strange things started happening. Usually, when you go to an ATM in Beirut, you can withdraw U.S. dollars from that ATM, no problem, alongside Lebanese lira. But then suddenly, people were not able to withdraw U.S. dollars from ATMs. Sort of strange. And then it didn't just happen the one day. It continued. And then soon, people were not able to withdraw U.S. dollars from their bank accounts. They were not able to withdraw U.S. dollars from their bank accounts, even if they had deposited U.S. dollars in their bank accounts. The foreign reserves that Lebanon had built so much of its economy on had depleted so much that there was no longer enough to go around as it usually had. And then as the Lebanese lira began to inflate and inflate and inflate, it lost, I want to say, a good 50% of its value. March.
Yeah, I think in the most recent one I saw, it had surpassed that, but it had jumped 35% in like a really short space of time.
Yeah, by March, by April, it had reached around, I want to say the number thrown around was an inflation rate of 486%. And then in March, the coronavirus came to Lebanon, which in the course of only a couple of days, because I was studying in Beirut at the time. I had come in January, and then in March, coronavirus came, and within a couple of days, I was told that I had to leave the country because they were going to close the borders, they were going to kick all the international students out, and everything shut down from there. The airport was closed, and surprisingly, despite the fact that inflation continued to build and build and build, Lebanon did quite well in response to the coronavirus crisis. But then in July, after kind of going in this kind of perpetual cycle of inflation going up a little bit, and then, but the coronavirus cases the rise being tempered, everything exploded. Inflation started to skyrocket. It went from 3,000 to the dollar to 4,000 to 5,000 to eventually 9,000. Somehow, some exchange houses had 10,000. And then the coronavirus, which had been tempered up until that point, cases began to rise, not by necessarily American standards, but very, like, much higher than what it had been at. And then, coupled with mass unemployment, people were predicting, I think, 50% of Lebanese people to be in poverty by sometime next year. People's savings becoming even more worthless than they already did. Then, around a couple days ago, on August 4th, Beirut's port, which is the main lifeline for the country, for which almost all imports, and Lebanon relies 80% of its food on imports, that, of course, blew up, destroying half the city, according to some estimates, leaving 300,000 people homeless, destroying the port, annihilating it, throwing dangerous chemicals into the air, and now Lebanese army is pretty much nowhere to be seen, relying on countries to come in from all around the world to give the kind of aid that the government would give in that situation, and people continuing to point fingers at one another without any sort of real accountability.
Okay, so thanks for the summation. I think it's really important that we get that in place, because there is now, you know, port authority pointing at ministerial departments, and then you've got members of the opposition, you've got, and, you know, Lebanon by design was already, I'm going to use that word again, in almost in an Irish context, a sectarian kind of way that power was devolved. You know, there was representation of different religions and different aspects of the society. Just in terms of the what's happened since, we have seen, you know, aid has been offered from certain quarters that has been, well, I can't get my head around it, that I saw today they're saying we don't want the aid from France. Why would you say something like that?
I don't think I saw, where did you see that they were refusing the aid from France?
It actually came from a buddy of mine in Iraq, in Ibril, who was saying that he'd seen that they were sitting on the idea, they were saying to France that they're not happy at the moment to certain aspects of the government to take aid from France, and that they had allowed some aid from Israel. Am I right in saying that?
There's a bit of a confusion within the kind of Lebanese political sphere about that. Yesterday, when Macron came by, it was a massive PR coup for him and I guess Lebanese politicians, because he was met with tons of crowds coming and hugging him and demanding that he take out Lebanese politicians. Though there were some people who obviously were not pleased as such. But many of the Lebanese politicians, at least that I've seen, are fine with taking French aid, though I'm sure there are Lebanese politicians who would not, probably from the resistance axis linked bloc, with Hezbollah and the like. Israeli aid, that's a more, I think the right word might be dubious.
Yeah.
Khan News, which is the Israeli state broadcaster, put out a report saying that Lebanon had accepted Israeli aid, but through unofficial channels, and it would be given through UN mediation. But that is incredibly vague. It doesn't really hold up, at least right now, it doesn't hold up to any verifiable evidence that anything has come through. Obviously, like, Lebanon is fine to give aid, despite misgivings about the idea of a new French political pact that Macron was suggesting. They're much more willing to get aid from France, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Iran, all these different countries. But Israel, by definition, is not a country that you would necessarily readily accept aid from as you would then. There's no diplomatic relations there. Yeah. Lebanon is considered an enemy state by Israel at the current moment. Borders are closed. There's mines on them. Lebanese planes don't fly to Israeli airports. It's a bit of a...
very long, and, you know, Irish listeners might be familiar with we would have all grown up reading Robert Fisk and the stories of Sabra and Shatila and the things that have happened. So it's a very long and problematic, I'd say, history between the two states.
Yes, yes. And the issue is that you can easily, I mean, Beirut needs an immense amount of aid, an aid that really cannot be supplied enough by the world countries. But to considering how much international effort has been put towards this from so many different countries, to accept Israeli aid and risk a political upheaval right now at a time when things are so tenuous, that might not be something that the Lebanese government is willing to risk at this current time. It would just be a bit of a nightmare for at least some political blocs. Even if it would materially help, in the long run, it might cause a lot of problems.
Macron wasn't all that complimentary about the political situation in the Lebanon. And is there a suggestion that there are caveats attached to aid from France?
Not at this time. I haven't seen any verifiable specifics to that. But I would assume, based on, as I said before, a new political pact, those are the words that he used, that there would be some trade-offs for the Lebanese government in some respect. Talking about, he was talking about sanctioning Lebanese officials that are against reform, which is not something that, which is something that mostly American politicians talk about in that respect. But outside of those sanctions, I don't believe there have been any specifics named at this time, but also he initiated those talks yesterday. So those may come out as the days go by.
Just in the wider context, as I said, you know, Lebanon is like you mentioned France, and obviously they sat down at Sykes-Picot and they drew lines on the map, and they went, "We're taking this and you're taking that." And and to this day, you've already mentioned, you know, Iraq, Iran, and you know, neighboring countries. Lebanon, is it 1 in 5 people now are refugees from the Syrian war or refugees of some other conflict or such? Yeah.
Something along those lines, yeah. Lebanon is not a large country at all. It's smaller than, at least for American listeners, it's smaller than the state of New Jersey. And they have had to take in, on top of their already population in the millions, they've had to take in millions of Syrians. And on top of that, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Palestinians that have been there since, in some cases, 1948. Yeah. That when you have a refugee population that in many cases is not legally allowed to work in the country, and they have to take a lot of black market jobs, that can obviously, and because they can't work at jobs under the system, they need aid from the government, aid from national relief organizations, and that adds to the already massive burden on the economic system that is only going to be made worse by the fact that now many of them, even though they are in tents, are now homeless, don't have jobs to go to if they had jobs, even under the black market. Everything has been made significantly worse, whatever problems Lebanon had before then.
And poverty is getting worse in Lebanon at the moment, particularly with COVID and also with the explosion. Is there any light for those who are struggling, or is it just getting worse and worse? I mean, there are politically wise, the situation is very, very precarious. One might even get to say that it's in a pre-war state, but the effects on people are huge at the moment. Is there a willingness or a capability to do anything about it?
The willingness, yeah, there are two fronts to this question. The first issue about whether or not there's any kind of hope at the end of the tunnel on that, I don't really know if there is. The two people that have the most capability to, and I use the term change very choice, it's a very choice thing. Macron, if he wants to give, as he said, a new political pact to Lebanon, sanctioning officials who are against reform, trying to bring about reform from the outside, that brings with it, you know, an almost neo-colonial way of going about Lebanese affairs, and that has its own problems. Or they could wait for an IMF bailout. But the issue with the IMF bailout is that, one, IMF bailouts, when they are approved, are notoriously exploitative of their home countries. They infuse a lot of cash into them, but many times it does not alleviate the poverty situation very much. And in fact, it may make things worse long term, and that happens a lot. And even then, Lebanon's government is at such a truly deeply corrupt point that the IMF is refusing to continue these negotiations because they don't believe that Lebanon's politicians will cough up the necessary, they don't believe that Lebanese politicians will be able to actually they can't even do the part of like furthering exploitation, right?
Yeah,
like, that's
and that's actually a really key point here, because that negotiation was happening pre-explosion. And
yes,
the IMF was already sitting on its hands saying, no way, you can't pay, you know. And, and we know in Ireland all about doing deals with the IMF and how these things happen. Like, people quite quickly forget that the 62 billion bailout between the Troika, as we like to call them, lots of that money wound up in recapitalizing banks in Germany and France. And it wasn't so much that bailed out our own, it was other investors. And likewise with Lebanon, where you have nepotism and political franchises that have, you know, and it's corruption and has been corruption for the long time. And that they are built on a certain, the system seems to be built on foundations of sand. And for the IMF to be turning up its nose speaks volumes to their ability to pay. But I suppose, as sitting, you know, in Ireland, we have our close links to Lebanon in terms of, you know, we all knew people. I have friends who went off to serve in the Leb. They went off to, as peacekeepers. Does the international community seem to, the response seem to be appropriate? Or because I'm thinking of Macron, and I'm thinking, I know it's not the same, but in my own head, it was a bit crazy that when why can't I come up with the name of the church in France that went on fire, people?
Notre Dame.
When Notre Dame went down, they raised 500 million in like 48 hours or something like that.
I think even more than that, yeah.
Yeah, well, they broke a billion, I believe, in like less than a week. But like, in terms of Lebanon, this is still very much, you know, the international community should care. Could you tell us some of the reasons why it's such an important part in the geopolitical game?
I mean, Lebanon sits at the very least in economic terms. Lebanon sits on an extremely strategically important part of the Mediterranean Sea. It's between countries that are also very important to American foreign policy, Western foreign policy, Israel, Syria. It's nearby Turkey, which also exercises a great deal of influence over Lebanese affairs. If Lebanon is already very much under the heel, unfortunately, of foreign powers in the region, Saudi Arabia, Iran. Just a couple weeks ago, Turkey was able to get an Armenian journalist in Lebanon prosecuted for saying mean things about Erdogan. If, especially coming from an Irish perspective, domination by foreign powers is never a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be important to make sure that other countries, when you see them, don't continue to fall under that sort of fabric. Back in 2017, Saudi Arabia kidnapped the Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri. Put him in front of a TV screen to make him resign. And then when they couldn't get anything more out of him, they sent him back and he unresigned. I don't think that it is in the interest of the international... Well, I mean, it is in the interest of international community powers, but I don't think it is in the people's interest that Lebanon continue to kind of fall into this abyss where it is no longer an independent country. It is an independent country in name only, but it is controlled by any number of regional powers, foreign powers, European powers that wanted to use it for its own gain against Israel, or for Saudi Arabia, or against Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, so it's a pawn in a geopolitical game that we've all known that's going on in the wider picture. And when Macron says things like, you know, deep change, that does have echoes of a colonial past.
Yeah. Make no mistake. Lebanon's government is in need of deep change. that is something that has been pushed by protesters with great fervor since October. And especially now, I mean, there were pictures published by, I believe her name is Laura Bitar. There are pictures of people have put up nooses around streets in Beirut for the politicians at this point. It is a turning point for them. But the issue is that, do you think that it would be a better idea, and I want to just think honestly for the listener at home, do you think it would be a better idea for a change to the government to come from the people, from below, or do you think it would be a better idea for a country in France to come in, impose their colonial mandate, and do it for them and just kind of hope that it works out fine and that the government that preceded and helped form the current confessional system that you have now, do you think it'd be a good idea to reestablish that even in a, not maybe a literal form, there's a literal French mandate, but one where France has an immense control over Lebanon's affairs and tells everyone what to do? I think the answer is fairly obvious, but who knows?
We know. And we, like, you know, tied aid is a feature of the global system now, whereby, you know, we will give you this, but we I think some activists call it extractivism, you know, and this is one of the methods. Just if I can broaden it out, though, in a sense, there does appear to be, and again, I'm very careful to say that these are my words and not yours, but there are already, you know, signs of low-level fighting going on between Iran and Israel. There are, you know, where some explosions, are they accidents, were they actually operations, and what's genuinely going on in the area at the moment? And all of this is in the run-up to what's going to be one of the most contentious U.S. presidential elections in my lifetime. Is this like a powder keg at this stage?
That's difficult to say for sure. Wow. In terms of the Iran thing, Israeli sabotage, I would say that's more likely than it would be in Lebanon, just to be perfectly frank. In Lebanon, the source of the ammonium nitrate is clear. The lead up to it is clear. It's all been very, very detailed. But in Iran, Israeli politicians were talking about, oh, maybe it was us, maybe it wasn't us. We leave our operations secret. But in terms of on the Lebanese border, a couple days ago, there was an incident that is still kind of up in the air as to whether or not it even happened, where Israel claims that Hezbollah tried to infiltrate the border, and then they were scared off by Israeli snipers, and then, of course, they shelled southern Lebanon. Mm. So far, at the very least, Hezbollah, at least in the speech that I saw today, which I think finished about 30 minutes ago at the time of this recording, Hezbollah is not, as much as it likes to talk about how much it wants to, how it can occupy the northern regions of Israel, as much as it wants to talk about how it can easily defeat Israel in any war that it wants to, I think it is in the interest of de-escalating, not going into a war with Israel unless Israel pushes the button first. I think, and as well, because of Lebanon's extremely precarious economic, political situation right now, it has no interest in going to war with Israel at this time. It knows very much that that would be, despite my clear, my disagreements with Hezbollah, it is in the interest of them not to further war with Israel. Now, with Israel itself, that's a different story. Netanyahu right now is threatening a fourth election. He is being protested day and night by even some of his former allies. He has a corruption trial coming up. And Netanyahu has a very storied history of starting wars in order to make sure that his re-election is guaranteed. Or maybe not starting wars, but threatening to start wars. So, I mean, back, there were a couple conflicts in Gaza that killed many, many, many civilians, but it increased his polling numbers quite a bit. The issue with going to war with, I don't think a war with Iran directly is going to happen in the near future, not without an American spark happening, similar to what, if America were to try something like Soleimani, but maybe even more brash and bold. But I think war with Lebanon is much more likely, even if it is unlikely at this point. The issue with Netanyahu trying to start a war with Lebanon for popularity is that that would require him to win that war. And you can win a war with Gaza, no problem. They have air superiority, naval superiority. It's an immensely tiny space. And they are living in immense poverty.
They refer to it as mowing the lawn, don't they?
They do, yeah.
Which is horrendous.
You're stomping on a child that is very much already dead and claiming victory. But in Lebanon, Israelis have been trying. I mean, there was an article in Haaretz a couple months ago talking about how Israelis have been trying to forget the 2006 Lebanon war because of how humiliating it was. 38 days of intense bombing across the country. A full invasion of southern Lebanon, destroying entire neighborhoods of Beirut. But even then, after an immense military campaign, they were still forced out of the country by Hezbollah. Mm. Lebanon has been weakened very significantly, but Hezbollah has now much more battle experience in Syria. They are much more attuned to what a military conflict would look like. This is not a matter of invading Israel or something like that, something kind of grandiose like that, but simply in terms of beating back Israel from Lebanese territory, that's still very much a possibility. And Netanyahu would have to make a pretty huge gamble to really think that that might help him and just kind of hope that it doesn't drag on or become something that will sink him politically. Netanyahu is not above that.
It's hopeful that his internal dilemmas are focusing him more than what's happening externally. That's kind of a hopeful. I mean, it's a dreadful hopeful in this situation, but it is still a hopeful.
Yeah, Netanyahu is at his most, I don't know what the term would be, his most chaotic point in his prime ministership. He has so many things that he has to deal with internally, trying to delay his own corruption trial, trying to beat back his opposition rebels, trying to break them up, which he's been somewhat successful in. He managed to destroy the Blue and White Party without really even trying.
But they self-imploded almost.
Yeah. But the issue is that can he juggle all of these things and hope that a future Lebanon war will increase the poll numbers enough so that Likud can get a majority, that they don't have to be in a coalition with Gantz and all of that. I don't want to speculate too much that it will prevent him, because it hasn't before with other things, but this is the height, I think, of how many problems Netanyahu would have, and does he want to add that onto his plate? That's up in the air.
And there's also there's two ticking bombs. I don't want to use the phrase ticking time bombs, but there's two clocks that are against him. One, as you said, he may need to run a fourth general election because they have not managed to put together this yet. And then the second thing is potentially his ally in the White House has only a few months left as well. And I use the term ally in the White House quite loosely. I use it in terms of, you know, we've seen some unprecedented moves in terms of moving the American embassy and the things that they've done in terms of recognizing. And a lot of this, you know, some of it is symbolic, but a lot of it is very important. And that conflict is not going to go away anytime soon. And there has been no good faith in terms of dealing with a genuine two-state solution or whatever is the blueprint for that. And I don't mean to drag you into that. These are all my comments, not yours, Seamus.
It's all fine.
No, go ahead. Yeah.
No, what's interesting is that I think this is very much out of the viewpoint for a lot of American viewers, a lot of Irish viewers as well. the State Department under Mike Pompeo has been, I think, the most aggressive and the most, I'll use the word petulant, in very recent years, and certainly any administration that I can think of off the top of my head. The U.S. ambassador, at least in the Lebanese context, if you want to bring that back to that, the U.S. ambassador, Dorothy Shea, has become somewhat infamous in the Lebanese political scene for just how much she is weighing in on Lebanese affairs. She went on TV. She goes on TV many times in Lebanon to talk about, how Hezbollah is responsible for all of Lebanon's problems, and that it's unique among the Lebanese political scene for how many problems it's causing, which kind of ignores the fact that everyone means everyone, and the whole thing is that all parties are responsible for it. Mm-hmm. And this resulted in a judge forbidding political organizations from speaking with her because there was the accusation that it was causing too much unrest. And there was an article in Al Akhbar, which is a newspaper there, that revealed that she had been sending letters to Lebanese politicians, telling them that they were tools of Hezbollah and that they needed to divest from their relations with them. The American State Department, I think it's more of a propaganda point than anything. They constantly talk about, Lebanese government, should stop relating with Hezbollah. They should stop associating themselves with Hezbollah. I remember there was a press conference that Trump gave back in, I think, 2018, mm-hmm. where he was with Saad Hariri, and he mentioned that Saad Hariri's government had been instrumental in fighting Hezbollah. But Hezbollah was part of the government of Saad Hariri.
Yeah.
They were in the cabinet. Hezbollah was the highest vote getter in the last election. It has held cabinet posts through pretty much every modern Lebanese government. It's in every single part of Lebanese society. It's not considered a terrorist group within that context, even though there would be some who would agree with that statement. It's a party, and it's impossible to expel it as you would ISIS, I suppose, or the al-Nusra Front. The United States doesn't really get how that works, but it still wants to impose its Amerocentric view of it on Lebanon.
They're still fighting a previous war. That's
yeah, new, yeah.
There are so many parallels, and it's fascinating listening to Seamus. There are so many parallels with Irish politics, both present and past. So many parallels going on. Is there, and we lost one of our big peacemakers here, Seamus Mallon, is there
we lost Seamus Mallon and John Hume within a few months of one another, and they were two terrific statesmen, and I'd like to mark that well on the podcast. It's important to say that.
But I'm just wondering, are there those figures within Lebanon? Do those figures exist, those peacemakers that can bring everybody on board?
I'm not as familiar with Irish politics as I really should be. But the issue with Lebanese politics is that those figures, at least in the political scene, really don't exist. There are unifying national figures that hold a lot of unifying potential, like the singer Feruz, for example. But mm-hmm. Feruz is not someone who talks about politics a great deal. She's not a politician. Every single politician in Lebanon has, I mean, not every single, that's a bit unfair, but most politicians in Lebanon have history with armed groups that have done unspeakable crimes. There was an interview on, I want to say, Al Manar, which is Hezbollah's TV station, where one of the MPs talked about the reason why he's so loyal to the president, Michel Aoun, was because he saved him from prosecution for killing someone during the Lebanese Civil War. It's these warlord-esque allyships that have no place in a current political system, but because of how Lebanon is situated, these warlords now have suits, and they come in, and they have desks, but they still have that same mindset. Surely someone maybe more knowledgeable about the intricacies of Lebanese politics could tell you, but at least from what I have seen, when Lebanese protesters talk about everyone means everyone, that means that there is no one in the Lebanese political system that can help. It's all corrupt. There's no one, there's for example, there's no, in Ireland, you may not like Sinn Féin, you may not like the SDLP, but there are still figures within those groups that you can point to that you really like. The issue is that in Lebanon, that really doesn't exist. Everybody is corrupt, and you really just have to, there's no ability to really reform that with any one MP or any one governorship.
Well, this is the most uplifting close to a podcast.
I'm sorry that this had to happen.
But, oh no, it's true. Like all of the parties you point to, they all had their own militias, for want of a better term. They all had their own, you know, forces that would carry out at arm's length. And yet, obviously, it is something in our near and not so distant past that we can talk about in Ireland. I suppose the very final thing I would say from in terms of a question to you now is, given this explosion is so devastating to the port, the international reaction in terms of the Red Cross and these sort of institutions, how can people help? I've seen people talk about it. Are there ways that you think that we could be putting influence on our own politicians, or is it just cash money we need to be giving?
At least in terms of Ireland, I don't know what the current Irish government plans to do, but if they are sending aid, wonderful. In terms of donating to the Red Cross, I think that's a very, very good idea. Lebanese organizations need U.S. dollars. They really need U.S. dollars at the moment. Any kind of foreign currency will do, but U.S. dollars are king. If you want to donate to those organizations, those charity organizations, make sure that there is a verifiable link, that they're trusted. Because a lot of people that I know in the first day of the explosion, they donated to a lot of organizations that were very sketchy. Make sure that the Red Cross links that you go to are legit. But I think donation at this current time is a very, very good idea. Pressure, I think, would take too long. Right now, this is an immediate thing that needs to happen. That can be something that is more in the future when there's more ramifications to deal with.
Where can our listeners find you, Seamus?
They can find me on Twitter at Seamus underscore Malik, SEAMUS underscore MALEK. I have a website that is just my name with a hyphen in between it. And I also have a Substack that you all can subscribe to where I write long form analysis pieces. I'm going to put one out about the United Arab Emirates and they're building a city on Mars. This is a real thing.
Yeah.
If you want to read about it, when it comes out, you can go to malekafzali.substack.com, malekafzali.substack.com.
Malik or Seamus, I think we'll have you back on to talk about
We should be so lucky.
I think to talk about a city on the moon, on Mars, this is brilliant. It's fabulous. We have to talk about this again. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. And just to remind our patrons, price of a cup of coffee, guys, keep this operation on the float. Thank you for taking the time to come and talk to us.
It was my pleasure.
Talk to y'all soon, folks. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.